Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Pamela Sue Mann, Jenny Bill, Kathy Manzo, Alex Lefchuk, and more, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
This is Gart Williams, age 38. A man protected by a suit of armor all held together by one bolt. Just a moment ago, someone removed the bolt, and Mr. Williams' protection fell away from him and left him a naked target. He's been cannonaded this afternoon by all the enemies of his life. His insecurity has shelled him. His sensitivity has straddled him with humiliation. His deep-rooted disquiet about his own worth has zeroed in on him, landed on target, and blown him apart. Mr. Gart Williams, ad agency exec, who in just a moment will move into the Twilight Zone in a desperate search for survival.
How are you tonight, Mr. Williams?
In the absolute pink.
Cold winter this year. Seems to get darker earlier than it ever has.
Well, that's the way of the world. The rich get richer. And the days get shorter.
That's right. Stamford! Stamford, next stop! Stamford! Next stop, Stamford! Stamford, next stop!
Willoughby, the stop is Willoughby. Willoughby, the stop is Willoughby. Willoughby, sir.
Willoughby?
Yes, sir. Willoughby. Willoughby, all out for Willoughby. Willoughby, the stop is Willoughby.
Gart Williams hated his job, hated ad agencies, and hated Mr. Misrell. It was an extension of the utter dislike he felt for himself and for the things he had to do for his $20,000 a year. He glanced at Mr. Misrell with revulsion. How deep a man could dive to seek that small nugget of security that sometimes could be found only several fathoms below a man's self-respect. He'd been with the agency for 15 years, and each day it had become easier to say sir to Mr. Misrell, to laugh at his jokes, to deferentially praise him, and to deny to himself that this man was a walking, belching symbol of the 20th century huckster. That's what they all were, in a sense. Williams knew this. They wore expensive silk suits, but they were carnival men. They had deftly draped themselves with the trappings of respectability, but they were barkers and pitchmen. They could, Gart reflected, dress up their jobs with the terminology of Madison Avenue, statistics, interviews in depth, research, and all the rest of the pseudo-scientific jargon. They could house it all in sumptuous offices like this one, but deep down and close to the nerve of it was the ugly truth of their whole function. They were con men, as crooked and devious as any 19th century snake oil vendor. Fragments of all this crossed Gart's William's mind as he stared at the door, listened to the creak of chairs as men fidgeted around him, and felt the glare of Mr. Misrell's coldly accusing eyes. While somewhere outside, in the early Manhattan winter, catastrophe, like a dark and billowing cloud, was forming. I thought it was useful to actually take a reading from, of course, Rod Serling's novelization, or at least the novel of A Stop at Willoughby there, the short story, very much a short story, the episode that we're considering in this Resonance Rewind, as we turn to Kathy Manso for your thoughts on this particular episode.
It was very philosophical. It really got to me. I mean, it was short, quick, and right to the point. You know, there wasn't too much of a, I mean, there's a little bit of mystery, as it's always, as there always is in Twilight Zone, but you kind of could see the direction it was going in. You know, it wasn't too much of a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more one looks at this particular aspect, and actually a close family friend a good few decades ago actually did move for a very stressful job and did indeed leave life. It was, I'm not sure whether it was suicide, but he actually did jump off a train. So who knows whether it's life imitating art or various other aspects within that. But it is something where, apart from the denouement at the end, which is clearly, as I say, the final system, it's a two-parter. I mean, certainly with respect to Walking Distance, which was an episode we reviewed a while back, probably before you actually joined, Kathy, it's also regarded as one of Rod Serling's favourite episodes. And you can see the references that he gives in terms of the stresses that he's actually under in terms of having to cope with the advertising executives, in terms of coping with Mizrell's push, 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 Williams, push, push, push. And, of course, the betrayal that we see literally revealed at the end of the sequence I've just read, where he realizes that somebody he's mentored effectively has said, thank you very much, I'm off now. And by the way, you won't be seeing this account again. So huge issues there in terms of the characterizations, probably apart from, let's say, the salary of $20,000 a year, which back in 1960 was probably a significant sum. You're talking about the equivalent of maybe $250,000 or so these days. We haven't really got away from that, have we, Kathy? I mean, you know, there's still that tendency in all sectors of life almost to lose touch with really the whole essence of a life lived to its fullest measure, as the Willoughby conductor says.
Well, and that's exactly why this episode was so unique, in the sense that it wasn't, you know, usually you can really catch on to the sci-fi. It's not to say that it isn't, but it was very much very closely associated with life. It's something that we've all fallen into, I think, at one point or another. And especially for someone of that time, where usually, I think it also challenges like masculine identity as well, because they're typically the ones that are like the go-getter. They push, push, push. They always climbing the ladder. And this person is someone who's like, no, I clearly know what I want. It's not that. And I'm doing this for the wrong reasons, or for the reasons that aren't for me. It's for other people involved. And then on top of that, you know, that's how the betrayal even gets even worse, because it's like, this isn't even for me at a certain point. It's, you know, it's there's so many other people involved. So there's a lot of confusion, and no one relates to this person because they only see the positives, like, oh, you have this amazing job, you have this amazing opportunity. Even if you do like create a scene at work, they still want to keep you because they don't want to deal with the consequence. So there was almost no escape. And especially if you're focusing at that time era, like how many people actually were getting divorced or were changing careers? No one. You know, once you were in it, you were in it. And that's what you were going to do until you retired. And I remember he said his character was 38, 39. So he's like, he's young, but he's also old. He's in this weird in between where it's like, for that kind of time period that we're talking about, you can't really change your career. I mean, you can go and get another job. You could probably do a bunch of other things, which is what he was really aspiring to. But so much is, you know, dependent on him already by so many different factors. And then, you know, you kind of go into this dream where you're like, oh, that sounds way better. Like,
you mentioned, of course, the masculine side of things. Clearly, Gart's wife, who actually is defined as a woman of appetite and is very much the power behind the throne in many ways from that perspective. I mean, the set that we see in terms of the Williams home is clearly a fairly plush environment that they're actually living in. So they've clearly had an amount of success with respect to that. Do you feel any sympathy for her at all? Or do you feel as though, well, she'd probably actually have already got another husband before the actual cremation or indeed burial has actually taken place?
I mean, unfortunately, we don't get a lot of time with her. So she becomes very much a one-dimensional character. You know, she's already set up to be the villain. But, you know, I imagine if they got married at 21, let's say, and they, which means you're close to two decades of marriage. And what happens when you get married to someone and they say, these are their dreams, these are their hopes, these are their aspirations, and you're both on the same page. And then something along the way changes, because people are allowed to change. I think that's only something we've recently realized that. I mean, we live in a society today where most people are going to have three career changes. And that's a minimum. You know, I don't think it's unheard of people having five different careers in their lifetime, or even more. So you kind of, you know, I don't want to completely put her as a villain, because if you were promised something, if your partner agreed with you and you built a plan and a life together, but also there could definitely be involved, especially once you got the taste for it, you know, to go with the theme of appetite, where comfort is a very real thing, especially when you're dealing with societal pressures. I mean, they mentioned that they're in, I imagine he works in New York, but he's commuting from Connecticut. Is what they're saying. And that part of the United States is very wealthy. That's Northeast United States. And if anyone's ever watched an episode of Gilmore Girls, they know how expensive and how much pressure there is in society. I mean, we're talking about a group where most of their neighbors will probably come from what's known as old money, you know, and generational wealth. So, and it doesn't seem like they have that kind of background. So they're just trying to keep up.
The other line, of course, which I think this sets a template for, I mean, you mentioned Gilmore Girls, but I feel that in many ways this could have been a pilot episode for the very popular series Mad Men, which emerged a few years ago. You could almost see Jon Hamm, a part aspects of that character and the whole Madison Avenue environment as really the five seasons of Mad Men could be encapsulated pretty much into the 25 minutes of the Twilight Zone that we've just actually looked at, really. Again, perhaps signifying Serling's prescience and great creativity. Did love the nod in the direction of Bradbury, the Bradbury account. Clearly a nod in the direction of Ray Bradbury. And there are lots of sort of areas within that. But let's talk characters, Kathy. Which one or ones did you actually feel were positive? Could it be somebody left field, like, for instance, Garth's secretary?
she was so obnoxious, the secretary.
Like, it's this man has two Mr. Misrael, sir.
He has two phone calls. He's going back and forth. Why his office has two phones, I don't know already. Because you know they had call waiting at that time. And then on top of that, it's like, but you have to answer. It's like, do you not see I'm busy? Like, hire a new assistant, secretary, whoever. So no, she's not my favorite. It's a hard one, because like it is truly a very simplistic episode. It's very straightforward and to the point. And I agree with you. I think this, if anything, this is probably an inspiration to Mad Men. came before. So I think I have a lot of sympathy for Mr. Williams, Gart Williams, I believe his character name is. What's his actual name? His actor, the actor.
James Daly.
I think he played his role very well, but I think everyone did, you know. The boss, I definitely hated him. He was very obnoxious, and I thought, you know, the characters that were sitting at the table, no one having a reaction is ridiculous. Like, that's
but a classic example of toxic masculinity in a toxic workplace, perhaps.
Well, it also just shows a lot of suppression too. Like, you know, there's no one wants to exactly get in trouble, and they don't really know how to push those limits. And then you also have the wife who's playing a you know, she's definitely evoking the emotions of, like, you're feeling more sorry for this main character. And she has like a moment where she's trying to listen to him. And then it just kind of changes her mind.
She has another drink. I mean, I do feel as though there might be an alcohol problem somewhere in the relationship. I think that might be one of the key things, though, because the way that Patricia Donahue plays the role of the wife, I think I suspect she liked her scotch and whiskey somewhat.
Yeah, I think so. And then the boys, even though they had a very minor part where they're just fishing and carrying the rods, you know, they already knew him. They were like, hey, Williams, what's up? And I was like, wow, okay, there was no introduction necessary. I think overall, I guess I enjoyed the trained conductor, the ones from the fantasy, not the one from, I mean, they're both great. No judgment on either. But I think I like that he just, all he did was repeat his line, but he gave such a
Willoughby.
He gave a different intention every time. You're like, oh, it's the kind of place, it's here, it's outside. Very Willy Wonka of him.
And maybe that's the whole point, that Willoughby is a state of mind, and that is the essence, the heart of the story. It's interesting. I've also seen reviews where the Willoughby train conductor is seen as somewhat spooky and scary in terms of his approach, which I thought was interesting. I didn't really quite get that myself, but
he plays a role of a Grim Reaper in a sense. You know, I mean, But he's, I mean, I think the misconception about the Grim Reaper, or whether you believe in the devil or Lucifer, everyone thinks they're the bad guy, but they're just the person that's providing you an alternative option. You know, you have free will at the end of the day. and that's what it comes down to, is you can get off here, or you don't have to. It's up to you.
Okay, so have we settled on a favorite character?
I'm going to go with the train conductor.
And your score out of 10 for this particular episode?
I'm going to give it a 7.5. Not that I don't like the story. It was very short. You know, I wish I could have gotten more depth out of the characters. You know, I think I would have dived in a little bit more to it.
So there we are, A Stop at Willoughby. Music, of course, by Nathan Scott. Not that Beautiful Dreamer was originally by Nathan Scott, which is what we were just listening to. And we've heard what Kathy Manso has actually made of this particular episode, the 30th episode in season one of The Twilight Zone, of course, written by Rod Serling, directed by Robert Parrish. But that's all well and good. We've got Kathy Manso's view and the fact that the train conductor was her favourite character. What about the rest of the Resonance Rewind team? Well, let's turn straight away to our New York correspondent, because it does carry with it the whole notion of the travels and travails of a Madison Avenue ad executive, very much setting the scene for what in the 21st century would be the series Mad Men, I feel. And obviously his departure at Willoughby and his desire for an easygoing Huckleberry Finn type lifestyle. Pamela Suman, what were your thoughts on this episode of The Twilight Zone?
I can so relate. I think that I have to say that out of all the things that we've watched, this one, no pun intended, but this one really sort of resonated with me the most, to the point where this morning I had a very dystopian dream of this alternate reality that I could not get out of. I literally could not get out of it. I had to will myself awake and back into this realm. And I really think that Twilight Zone did a very brilliant job of really messing with people, getting inside their minds, their fears, looking at other alternate realities. And it, from that standpoint, it was phenomenal. And also, I have to say that it stayed with me. I thought it was sad at the end. I imagined a different ending, because I didn't want it to be the earthly realms ending. I wanted it to be the Willoughby ending. So that's the one I chose in my mind.
Certainly it serves as a perfect bookend to an episode of The Twilight Zone we looked at earlier in the Resonance Rewind series called Walking Distance, which also deals with a common theme with Rod Serling, i.e. trying to recapture one's youth, trying to remember a simpler time when perhaps we could live life to a full measure and work on that premise. Jenny Bill, your thoughts on this particular adventure in space and time?
Well, obviously, I love this sort of thing, and I could listen to Rod Serling talk all day long. There's something really pleasing about his voice. So I love his intros and outros. And for me also, because I love New York, and I do quite like public transport. And although this is the set in the past and the far past, they're still very, the conductors are still kind of quite like this in America, which they're not here at all. I thought from the offset when he went to the place in the dream, and then the second time when he went there and he nearly got off the train, in his reality, you did see him holding his chest, taking tablets. And I actually thought, this is going to be like, that's going to be heaven. And he's going to like go into the dream the third time and he's going to have a heart attack and he's going to die and he's going to end up living there forever. And so I was actually a little disappointed when it turned out that he'd screamed something out and then jumped off the train. And I was thinking, but does that mean he committed? Because it's never really made clear. Was he dreaming and in a dream he jumped off the train, or did he actually commit suicide so that he could stay there forever? And so that was kind of in my mind. I was thinking, that wasn't quite how I thought it was going to end. And actually, I think my ending was better. But no, thoroughly enjoyable. But I did think it left it a bit ambiguous at the end as to how he actually ended up jumping off the train.
Yeah, I think that ambiguity is part of its charm in many ways. And again, hats off to James Daly for really getting us to sympathise with a character who clearly has been successful. I mean, as he said, he's married to a partner who clearly has an appetite, and Patricia Donahue kind of maintains that being part of the country set, being part of, in many ways, the American dream of actually living in an environment where you see that the acquisition of wealth is very much the pursuit of happiness. It's written into the Constitution and so on. And yet he's always kind of hankered for something which is more a kind of more substantive approach to life. And again, that opening sequence, I mean, we actually read at the start of the programme, really, which launched Cathy Manso's view on the whole thing, from the novelisation of the short story of A Stop at Willoughby. And that whole sense of how he was relating to his other workers, etc., was quite fascinating. Also, the secretary, I think his secretary, he obviously had no sympathy whatsoever when the boss was actually on the line and said, I'm sorry, he's on the line now, you need to take this call, etc. So... Again, interesting from that perspective, especially when we're referring to the characters that we were seeing. I mean, Pamela, clearly this whole notion of Willoughby does exist in parts of America. They actually have a day which is a stop at Willoughby, not on the line from New York to Connecticut, but it's clearly sort of entered the aspect from that. Were you also taken with the dream work analysis of the whole thing and the fact that, again, as Jenny said, that ambiguity, did he actually end it all himself or did he actually step into the Twilight Zone because he realized this was a place where people knew him, the boys knew him, the fishermen knew him, he was actually welcomed into this family? Or was the conductor more a kind of grim reaper, as Cathy said, and somebody who effectively is the conductor and is seen as the grim reaper on, of course, the train to the afterlife?
Well, I would say, first of all, I don't think that many people know this who are listening, but Willoughby is a place in the boroughs. It's actually along the water, and it's a strip of it's not far from the Brooklyn Naval Yard. If you keep going down south towards Dumbo, it is an actual place in New York City called Willoughby, and it's lovely. I almost moved there. I was looking at some lofts there. It was really cool. So there is a Willoughby, but it is hardly like Maybury. I think that, first of all, in the waking time, he was holding above his stomach. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm no doctor, but I think that the heart resides somewhere else. I didn't know what was wrong with him. I thought maybe he had an ulcer, a really bad ulcer, but I don't think someone can die of an ulcer. Maybe they can. That was the waking time. So the sleeping time, a quote, dream reality. The conductor was a little creepy. He was kind of like, join us. But honestly, it was such an awesome place and they all knew him and the kids wanted to go fishing with him right away. I would have loved to be there. And I wished that he could have just been there and had a great life. You know, I think the whole American dream, that's the irony of the whole thing, right? Because was anybody happy? They were surrounded by luxury, but they all had their highballs that, as soon as they got into the house, they were not, it's not as it seems. Nobody's really happy. Everyone's busy. They're making money, but they're totally stressed out. And If I were him, I would have absolutely wanted to be there. So just like Jenny, in my mind, he went to Willoughby. He didn't die. Maybe his corpse was left in this realm. But in actuality, his soul and his being went to Willoughby, which does exist. And we all need to find it.
How did we relate to Patricia Donahue's incarnation of Gart's wife, Janie Williams? Because clearly he's turning to one critical point in the narrative where basically he's saying, I can't cope with this anymore. I need help, and so on. And we don't hear what her response on the other end of the telephone line was, but I suspect she might have had a slight alcohol problem and turned to the bottle for a gin and tonic. I'm just saying, she didn't seem to be quite, you know, solid on that basis. But do you feel, in a sense, that kind of relationship where clearly she views herself as the power behind the throne and so on, and James Daly's character of Gart Williams is somebody who relates to that on one level, but on the other level, effectively, you know, we have sympathy for Janie, is what I'm saying. Do we feel as though, well, basically she just was in a bad partnership? For her, she would have been much better off being married to Mr. Misrael, who could have actually push all the time, push. Jenny, do you want to take that? Oh, Pamela, go on.
No, I think I'm curious to know what Jenny thinks about all this. Are you?
I feel that the wife she's obviously grown up in a stereotypical role, and I think that I feel sorry for her that's her outlook on life. But that's, I presume, because obviously I don't know anything about the character, because we don't know anything more than we see in the movie, the program, that is her upbringing, and that's the upbringing that you marry a successful man and you live in the town, you know, with the white picket fence life, and you know, she's bitter because that's not being fulfilled. He's not fulfilling his side of the bargain. But I feel sorry for her because of that. If that's all she sees in life, then that's a bit sad, really.
Perfectly said.
I mean, it is very much arguing that quality of life. I mean, we've seen that Rod Serling, who had a lot of challenges with respect to the advertisement people, the network executives, trying to actually get his point of view across and so on. And I think that the way in which you're having to juggle. So, I mean, it's the artistic element in all of us, where effectively you're looking to get a message across to address that aspect in essence. But you're left with a scenario where There's a sense of unsatisfaction. And even, as I say, Mr. Misrael, whilst you can actually turn around and say that as far as he's actually concerned, he just wants to run the company as successfully as possible and obviously doesn't want to be seen to have any other aspect, he does become clearly a person who very much is an institutional bully, is seen as the leader of the characters who works through that process and has major and is clearly driving Gart Williams to despair. And the opening sequence where basically a protege, the person that actually Gart Williams has mentored and actually effectively looks to bring on board as the next step, etc., lets him down, and doesn't just let him down, he lets him down badly. He goes off with a whole account. Hence the reason I feel that this in so many ways was a template for the five seasons of Mad Men about Madison Avenue that we saw, that again, people might have been familiar with, certainly in the late 2010s, early teens. But we're talking about bullies, we're talking about stress, we're talking about family scenarios. Let's turn to Wales. Let's turn to Robin Pierce. After all, he's in the jingle, he's in the idents, etc. He did say this was a favourite of his from the point of view of episodic television and so on. The 30th episode of The Twilight Zone. Robin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I come from it to it from a personal point of view, because there I was sitting the other side of my study on the couch. I got a message, fully aware that Residence Rewind was starting at 7:30 tonight. So my life had slowed down to a walk, and I was living it full measure. Then this evil corporate entity comes up and says, we're starting it now. Push, 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 boy. Push, push, push. As far as I'm concerned, and I rewatched this again today, A Stop at Willoughby, it doesn't follow, it's very closely linked to walking distance, which we've already covered. It doesn't follow that scenario. It's a very close relative to, but it's very different in a lot of different respects. The similarities are you have an overstressed advertising executive working on Madison Avenue. I don't know how much of this you've covered before. And he needs a release. In walking distance, the guy actually manages to go back to his childhood. In this one, it's very different in that he falls asleep, a troubled kind of sleep, because he's had one of those days at work. And he finds himself in this idyllic little late 1800s place that, if you've ever been there, is very reminiscent of Main Street in Disney World. And, you know, you've got your bandstand. Interestingly, when he actually goes to this place, when he gets off the train, they are playing Beautiful Dreamer. I noticed that. And it's that kind of, it's an eternal story. Pamela Suman seems to be showing me a rune. I'm not sure what's going on. And distracting. All of us around this particular table, we are all of a certain kind of age group, and I'm even including the youthful Ms. Mann in this, that we encounter a time in our lives when we all yearn to go somewhere simpler, somewhere where life is slower, where people are kinder, more polite, particularly in this day and age, which is even more brutal than the 60s. I mean, I know I've certainly dreamed of this idyll. And, you know, it's actually, it resonates through the ears. I mean, I first saw this episode, I would have been about 23 years old. Now at 62, it resonates even more than it did back then. I think it's a beautifully acted, beautifully written piece. And Serling's unique syntax for dialogue is just throughout the whole thing. The music and everything about it, what's not to like? Because Willoughby is the juxtaposition of the harsh life that this guy has had. I mean, he looks at the camera with such sort of doe-eyed innocence and naivety. And, you know, he's got a ruthlessly grabbing, acquisitive wife. He's got the ruthless, uncaring boss. He's in a cutthroat business. He is clearly the wrong guy in the wrong place. And he needs something that's less stressful. And what could possibly be less stressful than Willoughby? And it's an escape that sooner or later, we all need.
Astounding things, then. You have to say, Robin, you're absolutely right, even though for the Siren Radio listeners who clearly listen to this on a Thursday evening, just past 7 o'clock, for some bizarre reason, I did actually have it set for 7:30 as opposed to 7 o'clock, as opposed to the traditional time, obviously always being 7 o'clock. It just shows we can step into all sorts of other areas. Pamela?
Oh, I was just singing the theme to Twilight Zone. It was somehow appropriate. It seemed appropriate. You know, I wrote
it. We need that on your latest album, Pamela. We heard a reveal on the last midweek drive of one of your awesome tracks, Hands, which I think would have actually suited this down to the ground, really, in terms of the reflective nature of the whole piece. And in fact, we might actually squeeze it in some way, shape or form. But certainly that sense of calm. And as Robin's eloquently described there, the way in which we see life suddenly getting too frantic, too fraught. And, you know, if ever we have this balance between mindfulness, between how we're going, we're going to come back to the notion that he's clearly been successful. But of course, the interesting thing is he's 38, and 38 is not, as Kathy Manso said, necessarily old, but it's not young either. You're in those twilight years. You're in that perception of how things are actually being perceived from that side of things. So, you know, it's all to do with, again, perception of the time, the precious time we have on the planet. Pamela, as we said, Kathy was quite clear. She definitely rated the conductor, the 1860s conductor or the 1880s conductor, James Maloney, as not being the Grim Reaper, although he could have been, but basically her favourite character. What about yourself in terms of characters for this particular aspect? I mean, are you going to go down the line of Howard Smith's incarnation in Mizrel? Will it be Gart Williams, James Daly? I mean, like Robin, I've talked about walking distance. I probably, if pushed, would prefer walking distance ultimately, but Stop at Willoughby, again, lots of charm. What about your thoughts on this one, Pamela?
Jim Daly. He, you know, he, I really felt for the poor sucker. I mean, he was like imprisoned by the pressure, you know, the push. I mean, it really, I was just thinking, aren't we glad that we are our ages now as opposed to back then? Oh my God, we'd be ancient. We'd be relegated to like the elderly. I think that I have to say him because I felt really bad for him and I wanted him to end up, I feel like I'm invoking Jessica now. I wanted him to end up in Willoughby. I wanted him to end up at this idyllic place that is very much like Main Street in Disney World and a place where I used to want to live. I used to actually, when I was a child, want to live in Disney World. I heard that there was an underground city and I really wanted to live there. And so I think that many Americans, probably people from all over the world, but specifically Americans, because that whole apple pie American ideal is so ingrained in the psyche with so many people coming from other countries and wanting to achieve the American dream. With what is the American dream? You know, so my heart goes out to him and he did not die. He ended up in the other realm, which, and you know, who knows, if it were Doctor Who, he would have taken a TARDIS there and he could have just been there, might have been on another planet even, you know, like another America. But I say him. And in my mind, he got there and it was a happy ending. So he's the one.
Certainly it seemed as though he was happily welcomed to Willoughby. And of course, we have that ultimate denouement in terms of we see the closing of the door and the gate, etc., which is the twist in the tale in many ways. That's the line. Do you feel it would have been better with that if he'd taken that twist out, or do you feel that was an intrinsic part of the episode that you needed to see that final kind of reveal in terms of, that's where Willoughby comes from?
Oh, no. I would have, if I were the person in charge of that, I would have said, get rid of that. It's too macabre. It's too sad. It's too depressing. It's too final. And I don't want that ending. I mean, who wants that ending? Do you want that ending for you? I don't know, certainly. I mean, look, I was in a dystopian dream.
Pamela, a few weeks ago, October 22nd, I thought that might have been my ending, but that's another line entirely.
To watch that on TV. I mean, that's the thing, right? Who wants to watch these violent things on TV when there's enough of it in the world? No, I would not have had that.
Jenny, what about yourself? I mean, given that we haven't mentioned Pamela's true favourite character, the unicycle, which is always important in terms of the system there, so that's great. What about yourself and the characters that we see? I mean, would you actually go left field and say, obviously it has to be Gart Williams' secretary, because she was so sensitive to his needs and desires and lines within the whole system?
No, I love the old conductor from the past in Willoughby. I just like that sort of older, you know, very polite, and I do see him as the Grim Reaper, and I personally I see Willoughby as his the main character's heaven. Now, for me personally, it would be hell. I'm a city girl, and I would want to be in a city. But the idea of Willoughby and peace and quiet and taking it easy would be hell for me. But I think that everybody has their personal heaven, and that was his personal heaven. But everybody sees it a bit differently. My as I say, my issue was, did he commit suicide or did he just die in his sleep? So we never really know that. But no, definitely the conductor.
I mean, Pamela was absolutely right in terms of, yes, it seemed to be more of a stomach ulcer than a heart attack. But I must admit, on first watching it a few years ago, I did feel as though maybe he had actually suffered a heart attack, and that was part and parcel of the whole thing. And actually, he had died in his sleep. I mean, something else would be revisited many times as a standard trope. But Robin, what about yourself? Which character would you sort of go for in terms of, well, that's somebody who I felt stood up as worthwhile and approach. I mean, it could well be one of the two boys with their successful fishing trip, the kind of Huckleberry Finn characters that we actually see in Willoughby itself.
But before we go on to that, I just like to add my two cents worth to what the ladies have been talking about, particularly the end of the show, with Willoughby being revealed as the coroner who takes his body away. I don't really see the conductor as the Grim Reaper. I certainly never thought of him in those terms. I think it's just
a friendly Grim Reaper.
Yeah, I see it as him as kind of representative of the kindness and the nice, easygoing nature of Willoughby itself. Now, as to the actual end of the show, I think that Serling kind of over-egged the pudding here. We didn't really need to see the coroner's wagon, the tailgate clothes with the name, you know, Willoughby on it. I think that would, you took it just a little bit too far. He cried Willoughby, and he jumped off the train. I thought that was also a little bit of a harsh ending because it makes it sound suicidal.
Yeah, exactly.
If it was me, I mean, we've already seen that he was like, you know, clutching his chest and obviously suffering stress. I think he would have slipped off to sleep on the train and just perhaps died in his sleep. He may have muttered Willoughby as just a last word, and then we would have seen him go to the place where, to quote Cheers, everybody knew his name. Mm-hmm. Now then, as to my favourite character, it has to be the central character in this one, because have any of us not identified with him in that position at one time or another? You've been wherever it is that you work, things haven't been going right, deadlines are looming, a deadline might have been missed. I know I certainly have. I mean, I used to love deadlines when I worked in the office. I used to love the noise they made as they flew by my ears as I missed them.
You know, I just had a wonderful idea. I think that we should start another sort of a thing at where we rewrite the endings of shows and movies that we're not happy with, and we come up with our better ending. I think.
Oh my goodness. We're going to be doing fan fiction, are we?
Start with Blade Runner.
It has a name. See, everything has a name. See, these are the days we're living in.
It's true. And so the alternate reality is there. Although, as I mentioned, actually, in the conversation with Kathy in the early part of the show, particularly pertinent is basically friends of the family and relations of my mother, the Hennigans, I mentioned their name, etc. Their son, who was actually a very keen and actually university academic, actually his life came to an end literally when he literally had stepped off a train, and people still don't know to this day whether it was a deliberate stepping off a train or indeed whether he basically had been confused and he was basically sort of, his mother obviously he'd just been confused and stepped off. So curious, I mean, that was in the 1970s. And again, I think it's particularly interesting from that point of view that you see, who knows, those last few moments, what actually goes through the mind. And maybe that was something Serling was also kind of channeling in his own way, apart from, as we say, I mean, we mentioned obviously his frustration with the networks, with the sensors, with the institutions and that. And of course, a lovely nod in the direction is the Bradbury account ready yet? You know, clearly, again, another epic lyricist when it comes to poetics and literature, Ray Bradbury getting the nod in that direction. So it seems as though the conductor is doing well. James Daly, of course, Gart Williams, who, of course, we've seen before in The Invaders. Robin, anything else?
Well, you mentioned the troubles that Rod Serling had with the networks. And in particular, there was... he wrote an episode called Death's Head Revisited, where a German commandant went back to the concentration camp that he had presided upon. And it was a really strong and darkly disturbing episode. And I don't mean to take the focus off Willoughby here, but the networks pulled him to one side and said, could he not mention the fact that people were gassed in these concentration camps? And he said, well, it happened. I mean, it's part of the story. This is a guy.
When your sponsor is General Electric, you have an issue with respect to that. So
who were at the time selling gas ovens.
Exactly. Let's turn straight to Jared Palmer, who has also been through what I consider to be now the official the Peers Zone. Jared, apologies. I think we sent you a link for 7:30 as opposed to 7, but you're with us now. That's the important thing. Share with us your thoughts on this particular element as a young person, way before the whole thing. And what did you make of A Stop at Willoughby?
I thought it was quite interesting, actually, especially with the way it was done and like the amount of pressure this Gart gets. And I felt sorry for him because he just wants to work and be left to his own devices. And then eventually it's just the pressure's building up. And then, like, of course, his marriage is unhappy. And then eventually he discovers this like escapism. But it's a bit, for me, it was a bit extreme, especially towards the end where he just jumps off the train and ends his own life. But it was very entertaining to watch. And I think I've gotten used to the jump factor is that anything can happen in these programs. And like, I have to be prepared to sort of like get out of my element and admit, okay, this happened, but of course, this is something that is completely different from a lot of TV shows I've watched. And I definitely did enjoy it. And I think the episode has become a bit of a popular thing coming back, as I think I emailed you a while ago that someone made a parody of this video and they an episode of Seinfeld called The Subway where you just have George pasted over. And I couldn't stop laughing when they did that. And I thought that must have been really hard for them to do. And I thought it was a really good idea to homage that. So, yeah.
Yes, I haven't shared that with the team as yet, but again, I appreciate the fact you did a bit of a deep dive into that. What about your favourite character? I mean, it's interesting, you've already addressed some of the key things that Pamela and Jenny and Robin have shared, and indeed Kathy earlier. What from your perspective, was the favourite character in this? Is it this conductor? Is it Gart himself? Is it his wife?
Ooh. I would have to say it's Gart himself. I have to admit, I just really find the character interesting. I find it especially going back to the work days, because for me, I've never seen these sort of things where there's much more focus on personal life for TV shows. And I think for me, although I have seen a lot of black and white shows, I think this one was a very big example of what people were having to experience. And I also think it's something that I would really like to watch more of. And of course, it's whatever the episode takes you, really. So you have to be just prepared to be thrown off your chair a bit for it.
Okay. It's interesting that, again, some 60 years after its original incarnation, it still clearly has this connection. It still reflects on that. What would your score out of 10 be, Jared, for this particular thing? We'll come to you first as far as this is concerned.
I think I would give it an 8.
An 8 for yourself. Kathy went for 7.5 because she was actually keen to actually see more and she felt it was too short. She would like to see it expanded. Jenny Bill.
Yeah, I think I'll give it 8 as well. I mean, Robin kind of, I think, reiterated what I had said earlier, what I felt about the bit on the train, the death, and I also agree with him about the name on the funeral home. I mean, I think it's fabulous and I love the music and everything. But yeah, I think 8 out of 10.
Pamela.
Well, that's really very tricky. I'm going to give it a 9. And simply, I'm only going to give it 1 point less because it wasn't, because of the funeral parlor door, you know, the dooming him to death. Like that, you know, that's minus 1 point for me. But I really want to watch see Twilight Zone. Like, we used to get reruns of all these things in black and white, and it was just scary and creepy on Sundays. And I was like, I would not watch things. And now that I'm older, much older, and to see that, to see how brilliantly it was done, I'm definitely going to watch Twilight. In fact, can you assign us a few more? Because it was just so good.
I mean, I just point out, Pamela, this is not an assignment. We're not assessing you on this. It's basically meant to be a fun sort of sharing of things over the whole place.
You're not going to get a grade and break? Like, you're not going to give us a break before a grade before we break?
Well, it's a possibility, but it's not something I actually have in mind from that perspective, shall we say. And Robin?
Oh, man, I was hoping for a PhD in pop culture out of this. Well, strap yourselves in, guys, because history is about to be made, because I agree absolutely with Pamela on the mark, and for the reason for the mark. The final shot is what takes this down from a 10. Walking distance, 10. Stop at Willoughby, 9. Even though it's one of the very, very rare examples where somebody's death gives him the happy ending that he wanted. Think about that one.
And I will also, I think, go for a 9 out of 10 for reasons that have been stated and so on. Next week, we go down the line of animation once again. And as the festive season is with us and we'll be into the second or third week of Advent, we'll be looking at A Christmas to Remember, in which an ideal opportunity for visiting Marineville through the eyes of a child is actually seen, as we again explore the whole notions of Tri-Tempest and Phone Sheridan and indeed marionettes ice skating in a fabulous scenario, which clearly, Jenny, already is scoring high points for yourself as you see the skaters in Stingray. Yes, that's A Christmas to Remember, the episode from Stingray, next up on Resonance Rewind. Until then, keep on resonating.